case, which is 96-2441 and 97-0851, State ex rel. Philip Warren versus Schwartz and State versus Philip Warren. The petitioner will begin. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, yet apparently under the House rules, particularly Justice Steinman. I'm always looking for a good entree, something that'll get your attention. And it occurs to me that you have, of course, given me that vaudevillian's nightmare of a very tough act to follow with the three essays in the theater. One of them was entitled Unfair Punishment. It almost seemed like that would be a good entree, but it was actually the first prize winner, Ms. Johnson's essay. It was really on point to what I believe is at stake in this case. How are you supposed to know the toy doesn't work if you can't open the package first? Doesn't that store, when it sells you that toy, tell you implicitly it's going to work? I did very well in commercial law in law school, and I think the answer to that question is yes. In this case, the Court of Appeal tells us that when a defendant appears before that court and enters an Alford plea as part of a negotiated disposition in the case, by which that person is allowed to maintain his innocence, and the state is allowed in return for that to secure a conviction. The Court of Appeals tells us there is no implicit assurance that once that defendant is locked out of the back doors of that courtroom, that he will be allowed to maintain innocence and not punished for doing so. In 1990, Phil Warren appeared before Judge Houck, who happens to be present in court today.
May I interrupt you? Judge Houck, would you mind standing, please? Thank you for coming this morning.
Judge Houck accepted a negotiated plea and placed Mr. Warren on probation. 5 years later, Mr. Warren had not violated any condition of the probation officer had imposed on him, none that had been imposed by the court. And there were more conditions of probation imposed in the course of this case than Carter has pills. My last count was, if you count all the subclauses, 32 separate conditions that had been changed over 17 times in a five-year period. No violations. At that point, the state decided that Mr. Warren violated his probation because he said he was innocent. Precisely what he said in court, precisely what he had maintained throughout. This court has accepted the concept that an Alford plea is an acceptable approach to securing conviction. And it is only, in a very real sense, part of a system in which plea bargaining is central to the administration of justice. If we go back for a moment to 1990 and try to put ourselves in Mr. Warren's shoes, consider the situation of the defendant believing that he is innocent, who is faced in the event of a conviction with the exposure to an extraordinarily long prison sentence for a very serious offense. A man who, under those circumstances, looking at the evidence in the case that the state has against him, is forced to weigh his conviction of innocence against the very real practicalities that he may be convicted in, even if the odds in his favor are good. The very, very strong odds that if the case goes against him, he will go to prison for the majority of his life, or at least his adult life. It is impossible for me to place myself in that position, even empathetically. It's a position that I am fortunate enough never to have been in. It is, I submit, the position that Phil Warren was in.
Counsel, the state argues that maybe we shouldn't allow Alford pleas for the very reason you have set forth.
Maybe you shouldn't, but this court decided, no, it is not. This court decided, memory serves me, last year, that Alford pleas were acceptable. Moreover, the United States Supreme Court has decided that Alford pleas are acceptable. The courts have the discretion in any individual case to decide that an Alford plea should not be granted. I believe in our brief we mentioned, and I think it deserves mentioning again, A defendant doesn't get to come in and say, I'm going to do an Alford plea and stuff it down anybody's throat. It requires the prosecution to agree, or at the very least, the court to agree. A court always has the discretion to reject a plea. Moreover, this court has established standards to guide the trial courts in acceptance of Alford pleas, and those standards were, I presume, carefully considered by this court in reaffirming the vitality of an Alford plea. If this court were at this point to determine that Alford pleas were bad ideas as matters of policy and exercise its supervisory authority to ban them, it would not change the outcome of this case, because clearly at the time that this case was before Judge Howe, Alford pleas were appropriate under the law of the state and of the country.
What do you think of the judge at the moment they're entering the Alford plea, telling the defendant, did you do this crime? The answer is no. The judge says, I will not accept it. It's a variation of the Alford plea. You either admit your guilt to the judge, or that's the end.
I have been in front of courts to pursue that precise policy. It is not one that I personally cherish, because I think it makes the resolution of very difficult cases very difficult. On the other hand, I understand the reasoning process that some of the courts employ in that, which is, in my opinion, at least at some level, prompted by the belief that a defendant, before a plea is accepted, ought to know up front what is going to be potentially in store for him as a consequence of that plea.
Now, the reason this is important is because in a sexual assault, this took place here, any rehabilitation on probation, it's been deemed, at least from the medical community, that it's important that they deal with this admission, because according to the probation, that is significant as far as did they do it. Now, what will happen if we were to grant this, then basically perhaps Alford pleas should not be used in this type of situation.
I have always been troubled by a construct in which a person who says what somebody wants to hear is accepting, and a person who maintains something the person doesn't want to hear is in denial, and that means they're even worse off than we thought. And I have trouble with this concept. I believe that medically there are different schools of thought on that, but I don't mean to evade your question.
Let me ask you. Right.
Well, you've had two shots, I recognize, and got not quite in there. But I guess my feeling is that we talk about the court's discretion. A court has discretion in deciding whether a particular Alford plea is to be accepted, just as it has discretion if I come in with the prosecutor and Ms. Mueller and I have agreed that for this particular robbery of First Star Bank that the defendant should receive a $100 fine. The trial court might look at that and say, not going to do that. That ultimately becomes a function of the judge's discretion, and I'm a believer in the proposition that justice is best served if judges have more discretion rather than less. Yes.
Thank you. Here's my concern. The way I look at Alford pleas is that you know, a defendant can either enter an Alford plea if the court goes along with it and the prosecution goes along with it, or go through a trial, maintain his innocence, and be convicted. I mean, the ultimate bottom line on some cases is the defendant maintains innocence. There are a lot of defendants that maintain innocence at the end of the jury trial. And I understand some of the arguments that it's part of the bargain. But once the court is engaged in sentencing, I mean, once the defendant's been found guilty, it doesn't matter, to me, whether he's been found guilty by guilty plea, no contest plea, Alford plea, jury trial, court trial. He's guilty. And the court has to take into consideration at the time of sentencing those kinds of things that will protect the community and rehabilitate the defendant. And it seems to me that to say, well, you know, here we've got a situation where the defendant won't admit, and therefore, apparently, according to the professionals, it's impeding any treatment plan, is the same kind of problem you have at the end of a guilty verdict, where the court decides to put a defendant on probation, give him an opportunity to try to live in the community. He goes into treatment, denies, it's unsuccessful, and the risk continues there for the community. So I guess I'd like you to address my concerns about that.
You're looking at it through the wrong end of the telescope. Let's agree with everything you're saying for purposes of the argument. The question is how we got to that point. You tell me I can't do this Alford plea and maintain innocence. Okay, fine. We're going to have a trial. You have changed the calculus that goes into my decision whether or not to plead guilty.
But the problem with your premise is that the court has to tell the defendant
that if there's a condition down there, whether it be in treatment by the probation agent, that conflicts with your guilty plea, your maintenance of guilty, that you ought to know that in advance. And I don't know if the court's going to know that in fact the treatment plan may or may not require that later on.
No, but there ought to be the equivalent of the sign above the cash register that says, caution customer, we're not going to refund your money if this toy is defective and you've opened the package outside the store. You ought to at least tell somebody up front that the logical and rational and common sense understanding of what this person is doing won't apply. I think any other way...
But how is the court going to know if it's going to apply or not apply in any given case? Whether the treatment plan is going to require an admission or not, whether it be alcoholism, whether it be sexual problems, whether it be other kinds of problems.
I don't propose you turn the court into a therapist, but I do propose that we turn the plea into a voluntary and knowing act, and I think that the circumstances the court contemplates, that in an alcohol plea situation, the individual is going to be expected to admit guilt down the road. The court...
Do we know that everybody knew that? The court knew that at the time the plea was taken? That the court knew that that was going to be required of the defendant?
I have not asked Judge Halkin. I would bet you anything that it didn't cross his mind.
Counsel, thank you. And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Warren has two attorneys that provided the argument.
Hey, please, the court. Just to follow up on...
State your name, please, for everybody on the record.
Attorney Dave Cook, representing Mr. Warren on his post-conviction motions that were filed after the revocation proceedings. Just to follow up on the last question that was being discussed, in this case, there was no notice given to Mr. Warren at the time of the plea that as a condition of his sentence, he would have to admit guilt. And I don't believe that's contested at all. The defendant testified that he did not have notice.
My question is, was that notice, did anybody know that that might be a problem? I mean, there are lots of people that go into treatment denying, and part of the treatment process is to get them to admit. And other treatment programs may never require that there be admission. They just try to work on the side issues. And so my question is, how would the court or the parties have known at the time of the plea that this was going to be a requirement in the treatment program in which he was going to be engaging?
If the Department of Corrections, as a matter of their own policy for treating convicted sex offenders, says that we are going to require an admission of guilt as part of
our treatment. Is there a policy to that effect at the time of the plea?
There is nothing in the record at all that suggests that there was. In fact, the record seems to indicate that there wasn't at the time of the plea. With respect to what the court knew at the time of the plea, the court said the court did impose a requirement that Mr. Warren participate in good faith in counseling. But the court also stated at the post-conviction motion that the court did not say that Mr. Warren would have to admit guilt as part of his probation condition because the court wasn't aware. The court said, frankly, I wasn't aware at the time that he would have to do that. So I think it's clear that from the court's perspective, Mr. Warren did not have notice at the time of the plea.
Let me put this in a question of law context, if I can. As I understood your brief, the defense position, or at least one of the defense positions, is that this protestation of innocence lasts all the time. It starts at the trial or at the sentencing or pre-sentence, and it lasts through the probation period. The state's position is that the Alford plea is a plea, and it only lasts until sentencing. After that, another way of stating what just stated, after that, the defendant is a defendant who was like a defendant who pled guilty, who was found guilty by the judge or jury, or the Alford plea. And that is a basic law concept that is different from your presentation and the state's, as I understand that. Is that true?
I think there is agreement between Mr. Warren's position and the state's position that if notice is given at the time of the entry of the plea, then the defendant has the awareness and can make a knowing and voluntary offer plea with the understanding that as part of the correctional process he would have to admit guilt.
And if no notice is given, then the Alford innocent plea runs throughout. Is that your position?
Well, there may be a particular case where that is not the case, but in this case, Mr. Warren testified that that was his understanding. His stepfather testified that that was his understanding, and his stepfather was present at all of the attorney-client conferences. The attorney testified that, that the defense attorney testified that that was his understanding, that this was a promise of a continuing ability to maintain.
Let me ask
why did your client wait so long to raise this issue? My understanding is that he was in a treatment program. He was put out of the program because he didn't admit. He was in another treatment program. He was put out because he didn't admit. Wasn't this the third time around that he was in a program before there was revocation?
That's correct.
Why did he wait so long? He obviously had notice as this was proceeding that the expectation of the department was that he was going to have to admit.
There is nothing in the record that suggests that up until the last, the completion of the third program, which was 5 years after he was placed on probation, that Mr. Warren or that the department had decided that they were going to revoke his probation for failing to complete that program. In fact, I think you can almost draw the opposite inference from the fact that he completed one program. He was not revoked at the end of that program. 2 years later, he was sent to another program. At the completion of that program, he was not revoked. I think the inference that comes out of that is that the department did not have a policy early on in the probation of revoking probationers who did not admit probation. I don't believe it was Mr. Warren who waited. I think in this case it was the state that waited 5 years to formulate their policy with respect to Mr. Warren and finally decided to revoke him.
So
then
what could he have been wanting by the trial court?
There wasn't a condition present at the time that he had to admit or probation was revoked. What could the trial court have done?
The trial court, at the time of the plea, could have informed Mr. Warren, if the court had known, that, Mr. Warren, you're entering an Alford plea, but I want to tell you that your ability to maintain innocence is only for purposes of this plea hearing. And once you are sentenced and you're under the authority of the Department of Corrections, you will not be able to maintain that innocence.
Let me ask you about the two remedies. So, because I want to ask further about just to be able to question. It seems to me between your client's two arguments. One is attacking, wanting to vacate the Alpha plea, vacate the judgment of conviction and go back to a trial posture. Is that right? That's one of the remedies?
That is not the remedy that Mr. Warren is seeking in this case. That is a potential remedy for an involuntary plea.
Okay. The remedy that he's seeking here is to revoke the revocation, to reverse the revocation.
Mr. Warren wants the state to fulfill the promises that it made to him at the time he entered his plea. The state made two promises. Only one of those promises comes into play with the probation revocation. The state promised that he could continue to maintain innocence. The state also promised that they would not seek jail or prison as part of the sentence. 5 years after he was on probation, the state broke that promise when the state sought.
Okay, so as a practical matter, what's he asking here? That he stay on probation, not be revoked? I mean,
yes.
That's the bottom line remedy. What can the state do in terms of treatment and in terms of ensuring the safety of the community if the defendant is not successfully completing what they view to be necessary for safety in the community? What can they do with the client? Can they keep making him sit in those treatment programs until the expiration of the term, despite the fact that he's through the treatment?
I believe in this case, the state is limited by the promises that it made to Mr. Warren at the time he entered his plea. That is, the state cannot seek jail or imprisonment for failing to admit guilt, and the state must allow him to continue to maintain his innocence.
So they could keep making him go for treatment?
Yes, they could, until his probation is ended. But I should point out, too, that when Mr. Warren was originally up for sentencing, a pre-sentence report was prepared. The recommendations for prison and jail time that came out of that report from both the psychologist and the probation agent were for periods of time in the county jail of a year with Huber release privileges or straight 8 months without release privileges. Mr. Warren has served almost twice that amount already, more than what was recommended by the pre-sentence report. If the Alford plea had not been accepted, and those recommendations for jail time were based on the understanding that he was not admitting his guilt, so the state really has gotten more custody time from Mr. Warren now, more punishment than he would have gotten in the first place if the Alford plea had not been accepted.
Counsel, you're arguing in your post-conviction due process. If I understand, co-counsel is taking the position that he is not knowingly and voluntarily made. Is that distinction correct or not? Are you arguing due process and you arguing no and voluntarily made, or is it still part of the international?
I think those arguments are basically the same argument. A plea that is entered without knowing or without being aware of the central effects of that plea is a violation of due process under the Boykin case.
When I looked at some of the other cases cited in the brief, it seems that the knowing and voluntary remedy oftentimes was the withdrawal of plea as opposed to the removal of the condition of probation that you're seeking. And why should we go with overturning the revocation and removing the condition as a remedy rather than going back to the plea as it was before?
The reason for that, I think, you have to go to the Santabello case, which is the seminal U.S. Supreme Court case on the remedies for violations of a plea agreement. There is more in this case than just the fact that there was an unknowing and involuntary plea. There was a plea agreement. There was an agreement by the prosecutor not to seek jail or prison, and that agreement was violated. Because of that, an additional remedy comes into the picture, which is the specific performance of the plea agreement, which in this case would be to put Mr. Warren back on probation and not seek jail or prison. Now, the Santabello case says that the court has to consider, in determining which of those two remedies should apply, the court has to consider the circumstances of the particular case. And in this case, where you have a defendant who has already served 5 years on probation with very strict conditions of supervision that he has meticulously followed without any violation, and you also have a defendant who has served 1.5 years in jail and prison as a result of the state's breach of that agreement, it is simply unfair or unjust to say the remedy is to put him back to the beginning posture because he has already served 6.5 years of consequences as a result of his agreement to give up his trial rights.
Mr. Cook, do you see any problem with this court taking the approach that was taken by the Colorado Court of Appeals in Birdsong, where basically what they did was send the case back to the trial court with three options? The options being one, vacating the conviction, allowing the defendant to withdraw his alter plea; two, continuing the probation if the defendant agrees to admit guilt in therapy; or three, eliminating the requirement of guilt from the therapy condition probation. Does that in any way violate the Santabello?
I believe it would under the circumstances of this case. And again, that's why I think Santabello does require that the court, in fashioning a remedy, look at the circumstances of the case. In this case, as opposed to Birdsong, the violation of the plea agreement arose 5 years after the defendant had followed the probation conditions, and it really hasn't been resolved until now, 2 years after that, and Mr. Warren has served 1.5 years in prison. So the second remedy that was proposed in Birdsong, which was to place the defendant back on probation with a condition that he admit guilt, I don't think would be fair to impose on Mr. Warren at this point. If this issue had arisen immediately after Mr. Warren was placed on probation, where there was no reliance on his part on the agreement that he would make with the state, then perhaps that second remedy would be appropriate, as it was in Birdsong. Similarly, with the first remedy suggested in Birdsong, simply withdraw the plea. I think if this case had arisen immediately after Mr. Warren was placed on probation, if he met with his probation agent, the agent said, "You are going to have to admit guilt as a condition of your probation, or you are going to be revoked." And if that process had started then I think those first two remedies would be appropriate. But I think in the circumstances of this case, those are not fair or just remedies to impose on.
The problem I have with that argument is that it seems that underlying your argument is an assumption that somebody knew at the time of the plea that Mr. Warren should be advised of these matters. I mean, there's no allegation here that the state was what made this deal, actually knowing that the defendant would have to admit ultimately, or that the court knew. I mean, in hindsight, with everything that's known, at least from what I hear and what I've seen in the record, that was not the requirement at the time of the plea. And so the question is, can the state later on, by virtue of treatment plans and a professional play, require that as part of treatment? It seems to me that's a subsequent event. It doesn't reflect. It's not as though somebody was hiding in the weeds with that information at the time of the plea.
My argument is not at all to suggest that somebody knew. In fact, I think it's no one did know. I think if the...
Well, there was no obligation at the time of the plea. If we go back at that time, there was no obligation at that point to tell the defendant that he might have to admit that part of the treatment. I mean, forgetting what happened now. Looking at that time, you agreed that no one could have done that by virtue of what they knew.
Yes. If the department's policy at that time was not to require an admission of guilt... as a condition of probation, then how could Mr. Warren have been aware?
Well, the issue really is whether the department can later set that as a condition and then revoke based on
that.
Yes.
When that plea has been entered and those fundamental rights to a trial have been waived on the basis of a promise that I will be allowed to continue to maintain my innocence, yes, under those circumstances.
You don't take the position that a defendant found guilty by a jury and who is sentenced and given the opportunity on probation, and the defendant who maintains his innocence, and he later is required to go into treatment and continues to maintain his innocence, you don't maintain that he could not be released, do you?
Not at all. Not at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Just a minute. Just a little time. Your questions have handled. Okay. Thank you, counsel. We have a two assistant attorneys general arguing state versus another region.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, and I represent the state in the probation revocation proceeding of State X. Rel. Warren versus Schwartz. With me today is my colleague, Assistant Attorney General Michael Close, who represents the state in the plea withdrawal case of State versus Warren. Although I would like to address my arguments primarily to what Mr. Kalal has argued, inevitably there is an overlap between the two proceedings, and I am prepared to answer questions on Mr. Close's case to the best of my ability. The issue really before this court is whether there is something that is implicit or inherent in the nature of an Alford plea, which makes it somehow unfair for the state to accept an Alford plea from a defendant and then, at some later point in the correctional process, impose an adverse consequence on this Alford pleading defendant because he or she continues to maintain innocence of the crime for which that defendant has been convicted. The state's position is that there is nothing implicit in the nature of such a plea that operates as such a promise, and this is precisely what the Court of Appeal for District 4 found when it refused Mr. Warren's request for relief in his probation revocation case. However, if this court were to find that an Alford plea does constitute such an implicit assurance, then we believe the remedy here is to reinstate Mr. Warren's probation and simply say that the state cannot revoke him simply for his failure to admit guilt of the predicate offense. The remedy is not to allow him to withdraw his original Alford plea because there was nothing in that plea process that rendered his plea involuntary or unknowing. As the questions from the court have indicated, there is no way, as a practical matter, that the trial court knew that 5 years down the road, Mr. Warren's probation would be revoked because he still maintained that he had not committed the underlying offense.
Counsel, do you feel there's something unique about sexual assault cases? Can you see this issue developing in any other type of case other than those types of cases?
I believe sexual assault cases are close to being unique, but I could visualize the same scenario arising, for example, in maybe a homicide by drunk driving case where the state wasn't sure who was driving the car. They charged one person, and that defendant said, well, I know you've got enough evidence to convict me of being the driver of this car. I'm not saying I did it. In fact, I know I wasn't driving, but I know if I go to trial, I'm going to be convicted. Therefore, I'm going to plead Alford. I'm going to say I'm pleading guilty, but I'm saying I'm still innocent. And then as part of a correctional process, the Department of Corrections decides, you have to undergo some kind of alcoholism treatment. And as part of that treatment, you have to admit you have a problem with alcohol. And he says, but I don't. I wasn't the person drinking.
My concern is for the future. How do we avoid having to face problems like this in the future? Do you have a suggestion in that regard?
Well, if the court finds that there is this implicit assurance, then I think the answer is you don't allow Alford pleas in any sex crimes at all. Because in those kinds of cases, rehabilitation inevitably involves the offender taking responsibility for his or her conduct.
But there might be a change in theory. Yeah. 5 years down the line, I mean, the probation department changed their theory within a few years after he was sentenced. Why should we hold ourselves to that? Why not just inform the requirement that you be informed about what the present status is? That's it.
This court can always do that as a matter of its superintending control over lower courts. I don't think the court, if it chooses that route, however, should say that that's any kind of a constitutional requirement to make the plea voluntary and knowing, because this is not a direct consequence of the entry of the plea. It's very possible for an offender to enter an Alford plea and not have his or her probation revoked.
Let's assume the courtroom down the hall today, somebody is being sentenced sex crime and they enter an Alford plea. Do you believe that defendant has a constitutional right to be informed that he will not be able to maintain his innocence during the probation process?
No, I do not. I do not believe that because
it could be a knowing and intelligent waiver. Okay, go ahead.
Because if you look at, for example, the jury instructions on accepting an Alford plea, I believe it's Special Materials 32A, the thought of the Criminal Jury Instructions Committee is that an Alford plea should not be treated any differently legally or constitutionally than a no-contest plea would be. And what's kind of interesting about this case, and I think it's important that this court make it real clear in its decision, that an Alford plea, a true Alford plea, is a guilty plea accompanied by a protestation of innocence. It is not a no-contest plea. What happened here was really a hybrid. Mr. Warren pled no contest while maintaining his innocence. But that isn't what the case North Carolina versus Alford involved, and it's not what the Criminal Jury Instructions Committee regards as a true Alford
plea. If it's really nothing other than a no contest plea, why do we require them, and why did the U.S. Supreme Court require strong evidence of guilt? That's obviously a mistake.
Because of the maintenance of innocence, that's why you wanted to make sure that there was enough, more than the usual amount of evidence that is required to sustain a guilty plea. Because if the defendant is saying, I'm pleading, but I didn't do it, the Supreme Court wanted to make sure that this was not a situation, or at least fairly sure, that it was not a situation where somebody was being railroaded.
Do you agree that the no contest and guilty plea in Wisconsin it's sort of merged? There really isn't a distinction other than its implications maybe in civil litigation, but other than that in terms of a plea in a criminal case, whether it's a no contest plea or guilty plea, they tend to be treated the same way unless there's an altered component of it.
That's exactly correct. I think in the case law, this court and the Court of Appeals merges the two and treats no contest pleas to be the same as guilty pleas for purposes of any of the legal consequences that flow from the plea. The only difference being you can't use it collaterally in a civil case if you plead no contest. The only difference in an Alford plea, in the state's view, is you're allowed to maintain your innocence in court. And what this really means is, in a lot of cases, and child sexual assault is a prime example, it's a face-saving device. A lot of defendants cannot admit to their families, to the victims' families, to people close to them, that they have committed this type of an offense. It's particularly embarrassing. It is particularly repugnant. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. So a person who pleads Alford does have this advantage of not having to come into court and say, yes, I did those crimes that are alleged in the criminal complaint or in the information. So he or she has received a benefit. In addition, and I think this has been overlooked maybe even in the state's brief as well as the defendant's brief, the Alford pleading defendant in this case got a great deal. He was originally charged with two counts of first degree, I believe it was, sexual assault of a child. The state dropped one charge entirely.
What difference does that make if someone got a good deal?
Well, Well, I think it makes a difference in terms of Mr. Kalal's argument that the state really got a great benefit from Mr. Warren entering this plea, and I think he's overlooking the fact that Mr. Warren also got a great deal of benefit. And in addition,
should the court utilize its assessment of how good the deal is in analyzing the case?
No, I think that just kind of counteracts the impression that it's only the state that is getting some kind of a benefit by accepting the Alford plea. A lot of times, I think it, quite honestly, it's the defense attorney who is helped by the existence of this plea, because it's very difficult to get some clients to admit responsibility for this type of offense. But if you're going to say that there is an implicit promise that when you plead Alford, you can never be required to admit guilt further on in the correctional process, then I think you have to look at other impacts that the decision would have. If Mr. Warren had been put in prison instead of on probation, which he could have, and he serves, let's say he serves 5 years of a prison term, and the parole board says, well, we're not going to let you out on discretionary parole because you have not admitted your responsibility for this crime. And your failure to admit responsibility means that you're a greater risk out in the community. That would be a logical outgrowth.
And that's not an uncommon occurrence in the system, is it?
I think it's common, actually. Yeah. And another situation, one which I believe is currently pending before this court in a case that's been certified by the Court of Appeal, State versus Westcott, is an Alford pleading defendant comes in, and the recommendation as part of the plea bargain is that he gets put on probation. But the pre-sentence investigation report says this guy will not admit that he's responsible. You can't put him on probation. You've got to put him in prison. And the court, in sentencing Mr. Westcott, did precisely that and said, can't put you on probation because you're pleading Alford and you're not accepting it. You get 8 years in prison. Under the rationale that Mr. Kalal is espousing, the trial court wouldn't be able to do that because the trial court would be promising the defendant by accepting the Alford plea that no adverse consequences can flow from your failure to admit your guilt. And yet sentencing comes along and the corrections people say, you can't put this person out in the community because it would not be safe. I don't think that that would be a very good result from a public policy standpoint, from a community safety standpoint, or from the standpoint of a trial court interfering with the Department of Corrections decision on what is the best treatment for a sexual offender.
Counsel, we've got two cases pending in this court, waiting decision. One is Westcott and the other is Gary, as you very well may know. Let's just, for the moment, put aside this case. And you represent the state of Wisconsin and, as always, represent what should be the good law and good practice. So, for the future, aside from this case, does the state recommend that the trial court stay silent on this issue of maintaining innocence after trial? That's one way, which has happened here. Does the state recommend that the trial court advise the trial court or counsel advise the defendant that their maintenance of innocence ends in court and that it's just like a guilty plea? Or should the trial court advise the defendant that the defendant may maintain innocence and the stance of innocence forever? What do you recommend?
For a good policy result from henceforth, that the trial court should tell an Alford pleading defendant that your decision to maintain innocence does not mean that at some further point in the corrections process that you will not have to admit your guilt in order to escape whatever adverse consequence. I don't think you can name them all because you can think of a lot of different permutations on this. But I think there could be a general admonition to the defendant who chooses to plead Alford that this only pertains to his or her plea in court, that you are saying, I didn't do it, not that you are forever free to say it. Otherwise, you're actually giving the Alford pleading defendant advantages that a guilty pleading without Alford or a no-contest pleading defendant does not have.
Are there policy reasons why we shouldn't just say no more Alford pleas? Isn't that the easy way to take care of this problem?
It would be an easy way. Whether or not that would be good across the board, outside the context of the sexual offender arena, I don't I don't think it would necessarily, because I think that there are situations, one example given in the jury instructions is where you've got somebody charged with a crime that involves the assertion of self-defense, and the defendant believes and maybe has a good self-defense claim, but decides for whatever reason it is not worth going to trial over this, for financial reasons, maybe for dragging it out, maybe to protect the victim's family, and that person just will not say that I did this.
But isn't this a terrible public policy when you, and I wrote the concurrence in Garcia, which I really questioned the perception of the criminal justice system when you have someone who is saying, I'm innocent, but I'm still going to prison. I mean, what impact does this have on the system itself?
I think it is jarring, especially to a layperson, and especially if you might be the victim of that crime, to say that, well, this person is pleading guilty, but they didn't do it. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of logic to me, but that's, the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Alford that there can be reasons, and I think this court's well aware of them, reasons why you plead guilty but say you didn't do it, just for, in Alford, with very good reason, to avoid the death penalty. I mean, that's the best example, I suppose, in that case. If the defendant had gone to trial, he would have faced the death penalty upon conviction. And I think, you know, avoiding that possibility is a very good reason for entering an Alford plea. But in sex offender cases, I can see where it might be a bad policy.
Just to clarify, Wisconsin does not have a death penalty.
No, we never have. Thank you.
Attorney General Michael Foss.
If it pleases the court, I'm representing the state specifically on the defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea, but obviously as the questions and the discussion this morning indicate, the two issues obviously overlap. There's been kind of a general interest by the court as to whether or not Alford pleas should be even permitted in the state of Wisconsin, and in what context and in what with what requirements. Now, 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to argue the Garcia case before this court, and none of these specific problems were a matter of discussion or argument at that time. The question always is to whose benefit or what advantage is there in allowing Alford pleas to be used in the state criminal justice system? And I went back to the United States Supreme Court decision in North Carolina versus Alford to see what the primary focus of the United States Supreme Court was in authorizing and upholding the introduction and use of an Alford plea in that case. And it seemed clear to me that the Supreme Court was solicitous to allow an Alford plea as long as there was strong evidence of guilt in order to protect the bargain that had been negotiated by the defendant, which specifically in that case was a negotiation which allowed him to plead the second-degree murder instead of first-degree murder and avoid the possibility of the death penalty in the state of North Carolina. The Supreme Court, I believe, recognized there was a certain contradiction apparent in the use of the plea, where the defendant is maintaining his innocence while at the same time submitting himself be punished by the court. I have not had the opportunity to survey the prosecutors and defense counsels in the state with respect to their use of the Alford plea. But I think it's obvious in this type of case, where there's a child sexual assault case, that it is something that is used with some frequency, and that both the prosecutor's office and defense attorney see an advantage and utility to the use of the plea. So I would just like to bring the court's attention to that fact and to the concern which is kind of underlying the United States Supreme Court decision that initially approved the use of Alford plea.
Isn't there an issue really as to whether a defendant has to be forced to trial if he or she chooses not to? They've been offered something, assuming they are they're totally cognizant of all the rights they're giving up, isn't it a question of whether the courts are going to say, we don't, as long as you maintain your innocence, as long as you will not tell us you did it, we're going to force you to go through a jury trial whether you want to or not? I mean, isn't that sort of the issue as to whether or not the courts ought to force that defendant to go through the trial?
I think that's one aspect of it, and I think there would certainly be no compelling policy reason to force a trial in that circumstance. I think the other part of the consideration is the fact that if a defendant has been able to negotiate a deal that is advantageous and he understands the consequences and there is strong evidence of guilt, why should the court not allow that deal to be engaged and to allow the defendant to enter an Alford plea?
Because the court represents the public. And the court is supposed to look at everything in either a guilty plea or any plea agreement to make sure that the public interest in safety and justice is protected.
I agree entirely, Chief Justice. And in fact, if you look at the jury instructions, you look at controlling law, the trial court doesn't exercise discretion and is required to enforce the public interest. If there's some compelling public interest that indicates that this plea should not be allowed under the circumstances of that individual case, the court has discretion always not to allow the defendant to plead.
So we're not really talking deals, we're talking about agreements that are subject to court approval.
That is correct. I just wanted to point out that one of the things in the balance when the court exercises its discretion is the deal that was negotiated by the defendant.
One of the aspects, too, is the victim, particularly child victim of sexual assault, that if, in fact, the court satisfied that there's strong evidence of guilt and the defendant understands everything, it's the protection of that child or that victim not having to go through that trial.
I think there are a number of factors that would be involved here.
Under the present law, does the victim have to be advised about the plea agreements?
I know of no requirement. But obviously the victim is, in an ordinary case, the victim is obviously going to be in close contact with prosecution and be aware of how the case is progressing.
Mr. Kloss, there's an issue here, as I understand it, as to whether or not there was strong evidence of guilt presented to support the Alford plea. Can you tell us what the state's position is and why you feel, I'm assuming you feel, there was strong evidence of guilt? Can you capsulize that for us?
Well, the courts have never really clearly defined what strong evidence of guilt is, other than to use that phrase to differentiate between ordinary guilty plea cases. I would say a case where you have the victim of the crime testifying at the preliminary hearing, subject to cross-examination by the defense counsel, you have a strong evidence of guilt. As contrasted, for example, if you just had a weak circumstantial case, or if you had a case where there was incriminating statements by a co-conspirator but no significant cooperation. Now, here the victim did testify. Here we have the victim, 10 years old at the time of the alleged offense, approximately 11 at the preliminary, testifying at the preliminary hearing. That seems to me to be evidence, strong evidence of guilt, where you have the victim's testimony.
There were contradictions, though, with the testimony of an officer, isn't that correct?
I think that if you look at the preliminary hearing, the primary contradictions contradictions maybe is too strong a word, but the situation is the victim was able to testify as to the sexual context, and in fact indicated there were numerous sexual contacts. The victim had a difficult time relating a specific sexual contact to a specific date. And if you look at the testimony of the preliminary hearing, the two counts that were charged out were the two counts that the state, through the testimony of the victim, was able to relate to a specific date. And that's really what the problem was. I don't think there was any serious undermining of the credibility of the witness at the preliminary hearing.
Let me ask you, are you arguing that a preliminary hearing where a victim testifies is per se strong evidence of guilt? And let me explain why I'm asking that question, because it seems to me the case law on preliminary hearing is that, in fact, you could draw two inferences out of a preliminary hearing, one towards guilt and one towards innocence, and if they're equal, the commissioner or the judge hearing the preliminary binds the defendant over. So my concern is whether that's strong evidence of guilt by virtue of somebody having testified at preliminary, or is it just this transcript?
I believe this particular transcript. Sure, it's possible you would have a preliminary hearing where there was some serious groundwork done by defense counsel and undermining the credibility. I don't think that occurred in this particular case.
It would be counterproductive for the defendant to do that, wouldn't it? The defendant wants to put in an Alford plea, and then why would the defendant undermine the evidence that would support this plea?
Well, I'm not aware of what the counsel's strategy or decisions that were being made.
But this was the preliminary hearing that occurred before, right, before the information long, was filed.
Right, long before the plea was entered for considered probable.
I am still unclear about it.
Yes.
And that is this point about the requirement of the department that the defendant admit guilt. Is that a policy that applies to all sexual assault in these cases? Is it a new policy? Was it in effect at the time that Mr. Warren entered his plea? Or at the time, did they not have that requirement and then it's now put in? Or is it ad hoc matter that sometimes they do it and sometimes they don't? What's the fact of it?
Well, I have to admit candidly that the record is not developed on these particular points. We cannot ascertain from the record that was made in this case whether or not that policy was in effect when he entered his plea, at what point it came in, or whether it uniformly required in every specific case. The record just does not show.
But we do know that was the cause of revocation.
We do know that was the cause of revocation. And I think generally, people who work in this area, the experience of the court, the experience of counsel, is that frequently, in this type of sex treatment, an admission of guilt is a predicate to any type of meaningful therapy.
When deciding to accept an offer of plea, what's wrong with the judge saying, close to what the judge did, and that is you will have to cooperate fully with those agencies that service you during your probation? One of the matters they may require is that you plead guilt, tell your guilt. If you're unwilling to do that, I will not accept an offer.
I don't think there's anything wrong. I believe the plea that was entered in this case was voluntary and intelligently entered. I think what the state tried to do in its brief is to emphasize and bring to the court's attention the fact that this court and the courts in the state of Wisconsin have always drawn the line between the trial court's obligation to inform the defendant of the direct consequences of this plea without burdening the court with trying to anticipate, define, and explain to the defendant what possible collateral consequences might result from the plea somewhere down the line in the rehabilitative or the correctional process. Yes, sir.
I take it you are in agreement with your co-counsel with respect to, at the worst, you would hope that there would be reinserted probation. Now, my question follows from that. What is the practical effect of that on Mr. Warren?
Well, the practical effect, if this court would enjoin basically the defendant from revoking based on his failure to admit guilt, he would be reinstated on probation, and without knowing the exact dates, it seems to me that he is approaching having served 8 years of probation, either out in the street or in prison. So the practical effect would mean that he would be very close. He's satisfying his relationship, in my understanding.
Counsel, your
yes.
arguments concerning strong evidence of guilt. As I read the brief, you're referring to count one, yet when I looked at the transcript, I thought the plea was to count two. Does that make any difference?
It does not, and as a matter of fact, that is, when I was reading through that last night, sitting in the Radisson Hotel, I noticed that they actually did. The initial plea was to count one. For whatever reason, it was changed, and the plea that was entered was to plea two. I think in both instances, the two counts that were actually charged in the complaint were the two that the girl victim in this case was reasonably able to attach to a date.
So your argument, although
does not change.
It doesn't change, although it's an argument to count one, it applies to count
right.
two equally.
Right, correct.
Final question.
Yeah. Okay.
That is the Birdsong case. Boy, that seems like a case that's strong for the defense. And as I understand, the state's
response says, well, that deals with a written plea. It seems to me that that's much of a distinguishing feature. Can you distinguish Birdsong from this case on something other than it's a written plea?
I think so. The first thing is that the Birdsong decision involved a review of the revocation decision made by the department. It did not involve the integrity of the guilty plea, or in that case, or in this case, the integrity of the Alford plea. So that's a different issue. As I read the Birdsong case, I don't see that the decision is based on any controlling law, either from the Colorado Higher Court or from the United States Supreme Court. It seems to flow from a general sense of fairness that somehow the revocation of Mr. Birdsong's probation under the circumstances of that case was unfair. And as I recollect the facts of Birdsong, there was a negotiated plea, a written plea, and the condition of probation was actually established by the trial court, the Colorado trial court, that the defendant was required to participate in, I think, specific therapy with respect to sexual treatment. And under those circumstances, the Colorado court says, well, the trial court should have gone further and explained that he was going to be required to admit guilt. And if he didn't, we're not going to allow the department to revoke his probation. So I think that's very different from the issue that's presented here as to whether or not the plea is voluntary and intelligent. It is relevant, obviously, to the other case that's been consolidated with the one I've been arguing, and that is whether or not there's some due process requirement that the defendant be advised of the fact that he might have to admit his guilt before the department is authorized to revoke probation. And my feeling on that is that the Birdsong case is just simply not supported by any law. But the law in Wisconsin is, whether you read the jury instructions or the definitions of what Alford plea is that there is no implied promise or assurance when a defendant enters an Alford plea that he has a right to maintain his innocence in any correctional program, in any rehabilitative program, indefinitely until the sentence is satisfied. That just is not the law in Wisconsin. And whatever the Colorado court thought about this issue, I don't see anything in that case that compels this court or should persuade this court to adopt that type of logic. So I guess that's how I distinguish that case. My time is up, and I thank the court very much.
Thank you, Mr. Claw. We've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In answer to Justice Babich's question, the condition of probation was imposed in 1995, the condition that was the alleged cause of revocation. In answer to Justice...
That doesn't answer my question.
Okay, then I didn't understand it.
I wanted to know whether or not that condition of probation, in general, was a requirement of the department at the time that Mr. Warren entered this plea.
My understanding is that it was not. My understanding is that it was imposed in Mr. Warren's case and that it is not a department policy for all similarly situated individuals.
So
that is not correct. Is that right?
I believe that is in the certiorari record of the probation officer's file and the testimony of the probation officer at the hearing. I did not regard that as a central point of the issues on appeal, and that's one of the things that is probably lost on the cutting room floor somewhere in the context of preparing briefs and things of that sort.
See, my concern is that if there was a policy in effect, then it seems to me fairness says that he should have been told about it. If it wasn't in effect, then at least the argument that I think maybe is your strongest is that they changed the rules on him during the course of the game.
I think they changed the rules on him in the course of the game, and I think this ties into the question that I've been sitting here that I think I've been asked by Justice Gatsby twice, which is basically, you know, why should we do anything because the trial court didn't do anything wrong and we need to protect the public? And the answer seems to me to be that you can't turn the judicial system into an environment in which we change the rules after the fact.
Okay, if that's the posture, and I think that probably is the posture, I'm sorry to take so much time.
That's why I'm here.
What explicit